Hello and welcome to the Conversations Wrap podcast. I'm Christo Linnefeld, and as always, I have Peter with me. Hello, Peter.
Hi, Christo, and hi, listeners.
That's Peter Kukumur, for those who don't know who Peter is. It's Peter Kukumur. This is actually the first podcast of 2025. So it's been 4 months of the year that's already passed. And a hell of a lot has happened, Peter. I'm sure you would agree. But the last round that we concluded on the hectic conversations with coronation agenda was the one focused on emerging markets. We had a full host of speakers. We had Gavin Ubad, the head of emerging markets business. And he was joined by Mark Talbot, Lisa Hockman, Ari Sachs, and Suhail Suleiman. And they discussed a whole host of things that we certainly won't all touch on today. But the headline-grabbing bit of news, I think, around the time of presenting was, of course, all the tariff tornado slash tempest news flow in the US. And certainly, we've seen significant price movements around that time, with a very scary and very rare dual shock of equities and bonds selling off at the same time. So I've just got some highlights here, Peter. Feel free to comment, but I've just got some highlights here of some significant asset moves that really blew me away. Number one, the U.S. stock market suffered a historic two-day loss of $6.6 trillion, that's trillion with a T, in market cap. Again, that was just in 2 days. That would, of course, include all the major U.S. indices, S&P 500, NASDAQ Composite, Dow Jones. And this, of course, being the biggest, the second biggest sell-off was during COVID when the U.S. market lost over $5 trillion. But, of course, that wasn't in 2 days. That was over a span of a few weeks. Second interesting point was that the 10-year U.S. Treasury yield, as I mentioned, typically considered a haven amid market crises, saw its most violent break just beyond 4% in terms of the speed and the volatility of the move. And of course, this happened during a time where the markets melted down on the equity side. Oil, again, nice measure during crisis periods, dropped below $60 a barrel. Again, that's the lowest since April 2021. And then the good old safe haven of gold, which initially retreated to somewhere around $2,770 an ounce, rose just a few weeks later to its highest point to north of $3,500 an ounce, only to, of course, decline again the next day after President Trump retraced his threat to dismiss the Fed chair and optimism about a possible trade agreement with China was briefly reached during that period. Peter, what do you make of all of this? What's your hot take on this?
Yeah, I think hot take is the point to be stressed here. I mean, I think the most fundamental thing to understand about what's going on at the moment is that the U.S. political establishment is allowing President Trump to make policy through executive order, which means that the situation can change daily. And during April, it felt like nearly every day you had very fundamental market moving news that sent completely different signals to news the previous day. And it's just because you can make policy on the hoof, it means by definition that things are very fluid and can change very quickly. And that explains the very high level of uncertainty and volatility that we see in markets. So the wisest punditry today can be meaningless tomorrow because the situation can change. If you take a step back, I mean, quite clearly, there are two fundamental things at play here. The first one is a deterioration in the trustworthiness or credibility of the U.S. That's why you've seen the bond market spike that you alluded to, because quite simply, when a lot of investors around the globe are questioning historical assumptions about the reliability of the U.S. as a safe haven. And secondly, it's a point that is fairly well known out of theory, and that is that mercantilist trade policies where governments try to run trade surpluses and incentivize local production through protectionism is based on what often is a false construct, because it assumes that trade's a zero-sum game. And you just intuitively, trade only happens when both parties believe that they are gaining. So trade can be mutually beneficial and accretive. And you've had formal economic theory about this since the 19th century. It's Ricardian comparative advantage. A fairly simplistic theory, so I mean some holes have been picked into that, but at root is true. You've had many modern revisions of the benefits of trade. I mean, the strategy expert Michael Porter wrote a book about this in 1990, The Competitive Advantage of Nations, that again talk to the benefits of free trade. So it's fairly obvious that the trade system, that free trade is beneficial to all participants. Clearly, there are cases where tariffs can make sense, especially where it coincides with well-crafted long-term strategic plans to build competitive advantage in a specific country, in specific pockets and industries, and we've seen many examples of that in the world. But largely speaking, in the short term, trade wars create pain. And that's the second point that you alluded to at the end of your intro, which was Scott Bessent starting to talk about the unsustainability of especially the extremely high tariffs levied on China at the moment. And the reality is that a lot of pain will be borne everywhere, but especially in the US. In the first 2 weeks after the retaliatory tariffs against China were announced, inboard shipping from China to the US declined by 50%. So if that is sustained for any meaningful period of time, thousands of small businesses in the US will fail, millions of people will lose their jobs, and the political pressure will become unbearable. So, you know, as a base case, it's difficult to see that exactly where we are today. So in either in terms of the general tariffs announced on Liberation Day on all countries, or the very punitive sort of retaliatory or punishment tariffs levied against China, could last forever. But the key point to stress is a highly fluid situation. Things can change overnight, and it's not really worth spending a lot of time speculating about it.
Yeah, exactly. And I suppose we'll get into the weeds a bit later, but the reality is with this heightened level of uncertainty, of course, comes potentially a lot of opportunity. So you mentioned we're not going to belabor the point. There's limited use, I suppose, in providing running commentary on these global events. And for those seeking a bit more information on Coronation's views on the topic, I would definitely encourage you to go back and to watch the recording of the conversations round, where Gavin, I think, spent a hell of a lot of time unpacking the latest views on that. And I would also encourage you, if you are looking for fund-specific information in terms of how we've reacted to this in portfolios, I would encourage you to go and read the end of March fund commentaries. There's some really good and fresh perspective at a fund level in there. So, Peter, what I really want us to focus on today is firstly, those key things that clients and advisors need to remember during times of turmoil like this. And then secondly, I think this is a question many would want to know, is how are we as Coronation thinking about the world as it stands today? And specifically, how are we approaching the implementation of our views in portfolios? So Peter, let's start with the first piece. Let's start with the, I would call it the client crisis checklist for financial advisors. What would you say is critical on that checklist?
Yeah, the short answer to that is simple, and that is if you've done your planning right, you do nothing at the time of a crisis. It's as simple as that, and that's especially true at the end client level. You know, the whole point of financial planning is to ensure that clients are invested in portfolios that are appropriate for their willingness and ability to take risk. And as long as that is the case, meaning at the client level, the best advice always has to be to change nothing at the moment of crisis. One of the biggest problems that you've got from a client perspective is that you are suffering from a severe information asymmetry at a time of crisis, especially in a volatile and uncertain environment as we are in at the moment, where things change on a daily basis. So often, the urge to de-risk will be what drives decision-making. assuming the client's correctly positioned, that would have its roots in emotion, not in rationality. And the likelihood of doing damage is very, very significant. So, yeah, that's a simple part of the answer. How do you deal with this as an advisor? I think the key point is to remind clients about their positioning and their time horizon. You know, more conservative clients, those in retirement drawing an income, will by definition have more conservative portfolios and will be less impacted by events. All other investors have multiple years, often multiple decade time horizons, and should be excited, especially if they're still allocating capital into the markets, about the buying opportunities that are represented when assets are priced down. And then I think the final point there is just to remind clients to exercise patience, and to understand that if your framework is correct and if the planning process was robust, there really is no need to respond, and you probably are going to do more damage than good by trying to change the engines on the plane while it's flying, type of thing.
Yeah, I suppose maybe just to wrap that up, you kind of made the point already, but I suppose just to be a bit more direct, certainly don't be tempted by de-risking. That's the number one risk in periods like this, right?
Yeah, absolutely. And the only exception to that would be the clients whose portfolio positioning is not consistent with their willingness and ability to take risk. Then I would argue, regardless of potential opportunity costs, you need to get that fixed, because otherwise you are ending up in more trouble down the line potentially. And I think there's maybe just one other point to add. That is, from a financial advisory's investment proposition, the central portfolios that advisories run for clients, I think you have to think carefully outside of crisis moments about the amount of space that you allow your investment managers that implement at primary market level on your behalf to take the opportunities that present themselves on behalf of your clients. If the mandates that you grant managers are too tight, it becomes very difficult to add significant value. Some value can be added, but the more you constrain and the more you pigeonhole the job that you give your underlying managers to do, the more difficult it is for them to add value on your behalf, and the less likely it becomes that you are going to be able to make use of the opportunities that are available.
Yeah, so it's a nice way to get into the second part of the conversation, which is, well, what are Coronation doing about this? Of course, it all depends on the mandate you give us. But the real question here is, Peter, what are Coronation doing in this period of crisis to make sure that we make the most of the opportunity for clients?
Yeah, I think the key point is that we've seen this many times, and in some ways it energizes an investment business that is well positioned and well structured to effectively run the checklists that are well rehearsed and well practiced and have been proven many times before. So it starts with thinking about events and deciding whether it's a real crisis or not. I mean, this clearly is one. And the first and most obvious thing that we would do is you always expect that the immediate reaction of the market is very indiscriminate. And that sort of immediate urge to de-risk, where many investment strategies don't really care about which assets are sold. It's just baskets of risk assets that need to leave portfolios, to identify in that dislocation the opportunities that are represented. Because whatever the nature of the crisis is, it will not affect all companies equally. And if two companies, one more affected, one less affected, sell off at the same level, then quite clearly there's a relative valuation opportunity that has opened up. And secondly, one of the biggest decisions that you need to get right as an investment manager is when to fully load up on risk in terms of the risk budget of a specific portfolio at a point in crisis. Because if you wait too long, especially in global markets where markets react incredibly quickly to new information, you may miss the opportunity that's presented. And in every single major crisis before, whether you talk about the 2008 global financial crisis, the COVID crisis in 2020, the 21 Poli crisis, if you go further back to the dot-com bust in 2009-11, all of those crises had a moment where you had to have had increased risk to benefit from the bargain prices that were available over time. And the COVID crisis, I think, is very instructive, really, because it's arguably the first modern era crisis in terms of the velocity with which market prices have changed. You know, the buying opportunity there lasted 2 weeks and it was done. And markets started reaching new highs. So in essence, you know, so that's really what you need to do. It's that asset allocation call, you know, so risking up. And then within equities, it's really, I mean, often what you would do is you would sell assets that have held up relatively well and rotate some of that capital into assets that you've always liked that are now trading significantly cheaper, but in the assessment of the research process, have not been in any way fundamentally impaired. And then the other opportunity is, we think, is very useful to look out for at a time of crisis, is looking at ways to increase the quality of exposures. So again, if company A and company B in the same industry or the same market have sold up equivalently, but company A is much higher quality than company B, maybe you sell company B that you bought before because that was the more valuation attractive way to engage with a specific opportunity, and buy the higher quality company A that now trades at much less demanding levels.
Yeah, and what you do have is the North Star of valuations that guide you throughout this crisis. You know, you spoke about the optimism, the energy that you feel during these periods, and certainly I'm sure you've also felt it in the building. You know, the investment team get very excited. There's a real energy, there's a real buzz as everyone revisits their models, make sure they update their models to get to a fair reflection, given the new information that we have, of the fair values, and then, of course, acting accordingly. If you have updated fair values and you can use those valuations as your guide throughout this, you find comfort in allocating into the sell-off, which I think is very powerful.
Yeah, and it's like the only thing that I don't agree with you, agree with 99% of what you said, is just I'm not sure energy equates to optimism. maybe more nervous excitement.
Sure, fair enough. Okay, so I just want to unpack some of the things you've just said. Just, I need a bit more detail. I need you to just color this in for me. So you mentioned that just like in previous crisis periods, you know, this is an opportunity to step up exposure to risk assets. So talk me through some of the highlights, some of the asset allocation highlights in Coronation portfolios that many of the listeners would be familiar with. What are they, how are they positioned currently?
The strength of asset allocation moves would depend on the risk budgets of various portfolios, not necessarily the same level in all portfolios. But in a fund like Balance Plus, where it's about return optimization, long time horizon, we've moved very close to the maximum 75% equity limit under Reg 28. In the more conservative Capital Plus portfolio, the moves would not have been as material. As an example of that, I mean, so in the global space, we have both Global Managed, which is sort of more similar to Balance Plus, Global Capital Plus, which is more similar to Capital Plus on the local side. In Global Managed, we also had 75% equities, just like in Balance Plus, effectively close to the highest level we would go relative to its 60% equity benchmark. But in Global Capital Plus, we've been quite conservatively positioned, only about 20-ish% equity exposure. We've moved to around 30%, you know, so a more significant percentage increase, but still not deploying the full budget, just a meaningfully larger allocation than we've had before. Global Optimum, which is our aggressive allocation fund on the international side, went to about 75%. So as you can see, we've moved fairly quickly, and in the higher risk portfolios, we've gone to fairly full allocation positions relatively early in this crisis period.
Yeah, you also mentioned on the equity side this idea of improving the quality of the portfolio with a combination of selling assets that have held up relatively well. Some examples of those?
Yeah, so in developed market equity, I mean, it hasn't been that many, but an example would be Canadian Pacific Railway and some of the other infrastructure assets in the portfolio, which by definition are more defensive in nature. In the case of Canadian Pacific specifically, I mean, we've also had some concerns about execution and the quality of management, and the fact that it held up relatively well made it an easy decision to sell out of that. What do you do with the capital that you raise in that way while you buy other higher quality businesses that are not necessarily as defensive as the utility companies? So we deployed some capital into GE Healthcare and Thermo Fisher Scientific, for example, in the US.
And examples of businesses where potentially the conviction was lower that have also sold off, where we use that opportunity to buy higher conviction businesses?
Yeah, so again, in developed market equity, the biggest change there was in the semi or AI space, where we switched out of SK Hynix, which is sort of a secondary beneficiary of the AI trend, into NVIDIA and Broadcom, larger, more dominant, better IP US tech leaders. That have sold off quite significantly on the tariff and other concerns. And then maybe one other example on the DM side, we started building a small position in Skechers, the sort of discount footwear provider, which have sold very significantly because of the tariff impact, even though we would argue that the impact on them as a sort of a price leader or a price competitor would be less as US consumers trade down in the light of a tough economic environment and higher prices as a result of the tariffs.
Fantastic. I think we can leave it there, Peter. I think there's some good examples of hopefully Coronation using this chaos and turning it into hopefully an opportunity that will benefit clients over the long term, of course. Who knows what happens over the short term. Peter, thanks for joining me. We have another upcoming round of conversations with Coronation at the end of May that will focus on fixed income. For those of you familiar with the portfolios, it would predominantly be on the Coronation Strategic Income and Coronation Global Strategic Income funds, with head of that unit, Nisha Maharaj, being joined by Mauro Longano and Marie Antal and his team. Marie will, of course, also spend quite a bit of time talking about the macro landscape, both globally and in South Africa. Those invites should be in your inbox by the time you listen to this podcast. Please do RSVP for it. We'd love to have you. If you don't have it, we'd also encourage you to go and register for the Coronation Coro Hub on our website, a new initiative that allows further insights into Coronation's thinking and stores a massive library of some of the content that we generate, of which some would also, of course, be the conversations with Coronation recording. In order to register for Coro Hub, visit coronation.com. On the top right-hand side of your screen, you'll see a login option. Click on login and then register yourself as a financial advisor, and you should get approval shortly. Thank you very much for joining us. Until next time, goodbye.
Cheers, everyone. Thanks for listening and good luck out there.